My name is Jason Kapalka. That's Jason Kapalka. I'm the creative director and co-founder of PopCap Games.
Could you start by talking a little bit about your background and how you came to PopCap and what you did before then?
Well, I guess my career in, well, we'll see how far back I want to go, but my career in computer games started back around in the early 90s when I was writing for the magazine Computer Gaming World, doing various reviews and articles. And in 95, one of the editors from that magazine left to join an internet.com startup in San Francisco called 10, the Total Entertainment Network. And he invited me to come down there and work there, which I did. And 10 evolved over the course of the sort of dot-com boom and bust cycle from a very hardcore gaming service into what eventually turned into Pogo.com around 1999. And so I worked there initially on hardcore games, and then one day I was working on Total Annihilation tournaments, and the next day someone said, "Hey, design bingo." And so I was like, "Oh, bingo, okay." And so that was the beginning of my casual game design career, I guess. And yes, so I was there at Pogo. I helped design a lot of the structure for their casual games until around 2000 when I left, and Pogo eventually went on to get bought by Electronic Arts, of course. I left in 2000 and started PopCap with two other guys, Brian Feet and John Veitchi, who were these guys from Indiana that I'd met earlier around 97. They had made an internet action game called Ark that we'd produced on 10. And we stayed in touch. And in 2000, we decided we all kind of thought we wanted to try something different. So we all left our respective companies to start PopCap. As you might remember, 2000 was not the best year for internet companies. So we didn't really realize that the entire industry was collapsing. So we had an interesting time initially. And but yeah, luckily our ignorance kind of protected us, I guess. And yeah, PopCap kind of started from there, and just three of us working out of our apartments. And over time, we kind of like, well, I guess we need to hire an artist. And I was like, well, I guess we need to hire maybe another guy here to program this stuff. And then eventually, maybe someone should, look at the books or whatever. So we'll hire someone's aunt to take care of the, bookkeeping. And it kept going like that until eventually we thought maybe we need an office. And from there, suddenly we've got nearly 300 employees now in 2009. So it's been an interesting kind of experience. We never really intended PopCap to be to get anywhere near as big as it has today. Yeah, so I guess that's the story of PopCap in a nutshell.
How would you describe PopCat's place in the market today?
I guess it's a bit odd. Casual game companies exist in these strange spaces where they're often kind of the developer and the publisher, at the same time, and then they also publish stuff with other guys who are their sort of rivals, but also sort of their partners. There's a lot of this co-opetition sort of thing going on. And PopCap is obviously a developer, and we develop a lot of games. We used to publish other people's games, and we still do indirectly in that we have Spintop, games, which is a company we bought a couple years back, and they distribute a lot of other people's games through their site. But primarily, I think we develop and then publish, titles, but we primarily focus on publishing our own titles. So we're kind of a self-publisher, I suppose.
That's actually something I want to ask you about because one of your distribution channels now is Steam, which is another company's portal for their games and others. How do you see that relationship?
Well, Steam's been really good. We work with lots of different portals, so Steam is one of many that our typical PC game would go out on Steam, on Real Arcade, Big Fish Games, Yahoo Games, MSN, WildTangent, a whole bunch of other sort of some smaller channels. So Steam was kind of just one of several. It's been interesting in that it's developed kind of differently than a lot of those other ones. Steam is definitely much more of a hardcore game distribution channel than something like Real Arcade. And so initially when we started on Steam, it was kind of uncertain whether our games were going to really fit in. And initially a lot of the ones, we tried on Steam, you know, didn't really work too well for their audience. And so, you know, the hidden object games don't do especially well, you know, with Steam users, for example. The turning point for Steam was probably when we did Peggle Extreme with Valve. And I don't know if you remember that. That was Peggle had just come out, and the guys at Valve really liked it. And we were talking to them, and we said some weird ideas. Someone had the odd suggestion to do a sort of a miniature-themed version of Peggle that featured all the Orange Box characters, you know, the Half-Life and Team Fortress guys. And it was a really strange idea because, you know, that was a fairly mature, violent kind of franchise, and it, you know, certainly didn't seem like the obvious fit for Peggle. But on the other hand, we thought, well, you know, what the heck, we can try it, and it's only going to go on Steam anyway, so it's not like it'll offend, you know, the, you know, soccer mums necessarily. So we tried that out, and it went up, and we were all kind of nervous because we didn't know. It launched initially as a free download with the Orange Box. And, you know, even though it didn't cost people anything, we were still kind of wondering if there's going to be this big backlash from the hardcore community about, you know, what the hell is this cheap little pinball thing doing in the middle of my Orange Box, you know, product. But actually, the response was really good. I mean, the Orange Box guys all really liked Peggle a lot. And ultimately, you know, that led them to go out and seek out and buy the regular versions of Peggle, which, you know, made Peggle suddenly, you know, this, you know, fairly big success on Steam, which, you know, a month or two ago before that didn't seem very likely, you know, that this game with unicorns and rainbows would be selling well, you know, on Steam. So after that, that sort of seemed to kind of be, it sort of opened the floodgates a little bit. And now, you know, a variety of our games, you know, do very well on Steam. Obviously, Plants vs. Zombies was the last one that had quite a hit there. Not everything, you know, there's still some of our games that are clearly more casual and that don't particularly, you know, work well on Steam. But the ones that do work there seem to really work well.
There seems to be a fairly different expectation level for casual games in terms of graphics and such. Do you think that's a natural result of how they're produced and what they're intended for? Or could you see, you know, something like Plants vs. Zombies, but, you know, with the graphics levels of a Half-Life or something like that?
It's certainly possible. I mean, in some cases, we're not intentionally trying to make the games, you know, kind of low fidelity. We try to do the best art direction we can, although the usual contradiction or decision to be made there is we also want to make games as accessible as possible. So we want a game like Plants vs. Zombies to play on, you know, every, you know, crummy netbook and, you know, 7-year-old computer your mom has and all these types of things. And so that tends to sort of lean, you know, mean that we usually try to work and have good art, but usually make the technical requirements very modest. Yeah, we've been working at, you know, making things that can scale well so that, you know, on a good computer, you'll get a really nice experience and it'll still scale down to play on a lower end computer. But, you know, but that can be challenging in itself. So usually we err on the side of not worrying about the graphics being too high end, because our experience is just showing that a good game, you know, with, you know, not very fancy graphics can sell very well. Like Plants vs. Zombies, you know, and I think that game has good graphics, but it's definitely limited. It's only got 800 by 600 resolution and so forth. But on the other hand, we've seen plenty of games in the casual space that have really good graphics, and they sell very poorly if they're not a fun game. So accessibility and fun are definitely for us end up, you know, being the first priority over graphics, and especially, you know, 3D or, you know, sort of technically impressive graphics versus just good art direction.
You would think NetHack and Rogue would be the ultimate proof that you can have good gameplay without good graphics.
Sure, I love roguelike games. We have lots of NetHack fans over at PopCap, which seems a bit weird in that they're obviously not very casual in many regards. But they're good exemplars of that principle that graphics are not as important as gameplay.
A lot of your games, and especially games like Peggle and Zuma, things like that, the gameplay, to put it mildly, is pretty simple in terms of what the user can do. A lot of times it's just a mouse click or two mouse clicks. How can you take what is fairly simple gameplay and keep it engaging so that people want to play it for hour after hour?
Typically, the hard part is actually keeping it simple to begin with. Usually, the problem is that a lot of times games become increasingly more complex as you work on them, and it's hard to resist that temptation and sort of keep things simple. With Peggle, there's certainly one thing that everyone asked for was everyone wanted to have some sort of control over the ball once they launched it. So they all thought, I shoot the ball and then I can't do anything. I just sit there and just watch it bounce down. Why can't I have, bumpers or a laser beam or something that I can do? And and on the surface, that sounds like there's nothing inherently wrong with that request. But when you do things like that, it suddenly changes the game, and so the simplicity kind of goes away, and it's no longer as compelling. It's kind of like bowling. If you could control the ball after you throw it in bowling, that doesn't necessarily make it a better game. Or golf, if you had we've maybe had a game of golf where where you could, change the direction of the ball after you shoot it. Again, doesn't necessarily make it better. I think computer game players often have they want all this control, but I think a lot of classic games actually work well because they limit the amount of control you have, and so you have to really focus on these clear and specific decisions, and that's actually, that's a very engaging thing to do. I mean, I don't think games like pool or golf will be going away anytime soon. And they've fairly simple mechanics at the base of them. You're calculating angles and trajectories, and so that's the case of something like Peggle. It's a similar game. You're calculating angles and trajectories, and then making one single decision. But I think that simplicity doesn't mean that it lacks appeal, as you would say by golf or pinball or billiards and so on.
This next question, keep in mind, is coming from a guy who's now spent 3 weeks trying to get through the last level of Zuma's Revenge. How do you decide the balance between too easy and too frustrating?
That is quite hard. Obviously, for I think I once said that no casual game has ever failed for being too easy. But that's not entirely true. I mean, a game that is too easy, people wouldn't necessarily, they don't perceive it as being too easy. They just perceive it as being boring. And so you certainly don't want to have a game that's boring. At the same time, it's much, much easier to fall into the trap of making a casual game too hard. That's certainly one of the hallmarks of computer game design, is to make them very challenging. Because as a game designer and hardcore game players, that's sort of what you're used to. A lot of the DNA of video games comes from things like the arcade, where they were very pure games of skill that they were intended to get very hard very quickly. That's some sort of evolutionary development that's not really relevant in a lot of games today, especially not in casual games, but it's kind of hard to get out of the habit of that. So, with that in mind, trying to figure out how to balance things to be, the right level of difficulty is quite challenging. I don't like doing, sometimes people just have a thing where you can select, easy, medium, hard. We don't like doing that at PopCap, by and large. The problem I always have with that, it's really hard to calibrate what that actually means, because obviously easy, medium, hard are going to mean different things for different games and for different people. And so, if one game's easy, might be ridiculously difficult on another one. And typically you're asked to decide that at the beginning of a game when you don't actually know. So, I'll start up a game of whatever, whether it's Halo or Ninja Gaiden, and decide, okay, do I want normal or do I want easy? Do I want hard? In various cases, it could be any of those things, and you don't have any good way of knowing until you've actually played the game. So I don't like having those choosable difficulty settings, which means you need to have a game that can, has one difficulty and that people can adapt to, or it adapts to them as they go along. So that was a big challenge with Zuma, was to try to arrange the levels and so on in such a way that they provide an interesting scale of challenge going upwards without ever getting, too insanely difficult. Although, as you pointed out, the later levels of Zuma can get quite hard. Zuma's Revenge is a bit easier than the original Zuma. The original Zuma was quite punishing in many ways, and Zuma's Revenge has gotten a little more forgiving than that. But we figured that it's okay on that later levels if it becomes difficult. Because by the time someone gets to like level 60 in Zuma's Revenge, we kind of assume that they've got the hang of the game and are enjoying the basic gameplay. Whereas if someone starts the first level of a game, like a Ninja Gaiden type experience, and gets their ass kicked, repeatedly, that's the sort of thing that may discourage them from continuing to try it at all.
I'm going to go off interview for a second here and say the only problem with that is that almost all of the bonus play in Zuma's Revenge is locked to getting through the whole game.
Yeah, that is, and that's something that we've thought about and is actually on our list of things we would probably try to address if we have another Zuma sequel. If you ever see a third Zuma game, we'll definitely try to make some of that content more accessible, you know, before people complete the game.
The other way that sometimes difficulty is addressed is through cheat codes, and it seems like you've gone out of your way not to have any of that backdoor stuff. Was that a conscious decision?
Yeah, I mean, during beta, and actually there's a few Easter eggs and so forth we have in the games, but it really seems the opposite of casual to have, you know, these kinds of codes that you need to have the secret hidden knowledge, you know, whether, you know, digging through the internet or magazines to find these special codes. It's kind of the opposite of making a game that's accessible today, making one that you have to discover this secret information in order to play effectively. I think it's kind of fun, but only in that context of games where you expect the audience to be, you know, really so invested in the game that they're going to kind of go outside of it and seek out that kind of extra information. Which is quite common in, you know, MMOs and other hardcore games.
Is it easier or harder to do sequels to a casual game? Does the lack of a complex storyline make it more difficult in some ways?
In some ways, I think it, you know, it's obviously I haven't had to make Uncharted 2 or anything like that, so I couldn't say for sure about the challenges of dealing with, you know, a 200 person team. But the challenge that we find for things like Bejeweled 2 or Zuma's Revenge is that you have a very simple structure, and it's challenging to make that, to improve that without changing it. It's the problem I always had is the one that I saw with a lot of Tetris, you know, versions. They've been making, you know, versions of Tetris for years, and you see a new version of Tetris come up for a new system and you pick it up and check it out, and often they'd have some new twist on it that, you know, once you played it was like not very good. And you switch back to playing basic Tetris as soon as you could because whatever new gizmos they threw in there, you know, just didn't actually make the game of Tetris any more fun. They made it different, you know, but not more fun. So when we did, you know, Bejeweled 2 or Zuma's Revenge, my first priority was not to make the game less fun. You know, for the sake of making it different, so you can say, okay, you know, Zuma's Revenge has this many different things in it. That sort of helps with your bullet list of stuff if you're trying to sell it. But once you start playing it, we found a lot of the stuff we tried initially, we put in a lot of things. We put lots of extra power-ups, you know, in there, and a bunch of different kinds of levels and different boss monsters and a whole bunch of stuff. Mini-games, you sort of play Space Invaders type mini-games with the frog shooting at Tiki Invaders and so forth. But none of them actually made the game any more fun. It was one of those things where, you know, the mini-games, for example, it kind of felt more like you were playing Tetris and then suddenly you were forced to play a round of Bejeweled in the middle of it. You know, it didn't really feel like it didn't make sense. You know, if you're playing Zuma, most people kind of want to play Zuma. They don't want to be interrupted with some random other type of gameplay. Some of the power-ups, again, you know, we had some extra ones in there that just, they're different. They just didn't add a lot to the gameplay and it didn't make it any more fun. So it can be challenging to add stuff and modify a game that has a lot of fans and that is very simple, because, you know, it's not easy to, you know, change that without breaking it. It's like trying to make chess 2. You know, many people have made up all sorts of different variant rules for chess, but I don't think too many people would claim that they had improved chess in any universal way. So when we're working on Zuma or something like that, in a sense, we feel like our job is to try and improve chess, some sort of game that's very simple, but, you know, to some extent, you know, classic in that it's been around for a while and is loved in its current form by a lot of people. And so you don't want to mess that up just for the sake of saying you changed some stuff and made a sequel that was different.
I'm going to morph together a couple of questions that came out of our editors, because some of them were similar and they all kind of are on the theme. So I'm just going to read them all and then you can figure out how to amalgamize them. The first one was, can you describe your development platform, including frameworks and programming languages used, and how that relates to target customer platforms? Someone else asked, how do you manage development for games that need to run on multiple platforms? Is that changing with the popularity of mobile platforms like iPhone, Android, and Pre? What about mobile platforms like netbooks and Chrome OS? And then someone else asked if you were still planning to develop for WebOS.
Okay. Well, our usual platform we develop on is typically for PC and using C++ as the programming language. That's for a fair number of years now, that's been our default. So when a game is started, that's usually typically the way we develop it. And at later on, once that we call that our reference build, you know, if we do that, typically we'll figure out where to port it to after that. And some of the ports are somewhat easy and can involve a lot of the same C++ code, you know, if you're doing a port to Xbox, for example. Other times, if it's Flash, for example, or, you know, some Brew mobile handset, it has to more or less, it ends up being a fairly major rewrite, so you don't get to, you know, we don't have a magic button that ports Peggle onto every different platform available. Sometimes you just have to do it the hard way and do a lot of rewriting of the code and revising the graphics and layout and UI and all that stuff. So we definitely think it's important to do other platforms, but we certainly feel like you have to take a lot of care to make sure that the game works properly on whatever that platform is. So we do spend a lot of time and effort on ports. I guess we think of them less as a straightforward port than as an adaptation, because the challenges of doing Bejeweled on the iPhone, for example, are significantly different than doing it on Xbox or, you know, some other, you know, kind of device. There was a bunch of questions. Let me think.
Mobile, like netbooks and Chrome OS.
We definitely are trying to keep netbooks in mind when we do games, so that even if we have a game like Zuma's Revenge, which has some high-res options, it'll still scale down to run on a typical netbook. And that's unlikely to change. We'll probably try to, you know, we certainly are well aware that a lot of our audience has lower-end computers. So in a sense, netbooks don't cause us any problems because we were already making games that played on, you know, that kind of computer. So we don't really have to do anything extra special to make our games work on a netbook.
I was just going to say, but I could tell you that I think your Mac port doesn't like running on Hackintoshes, because I tried using Zuma's Revenge on a Hackintosh Dell 10V, and I think you probably didn't optimize your Mac version as much as some of the other ones.
It may be true. Our Mac versions are definitely, our Mac ports, we've had some troubles with those over the years, and we don't yet have a 100% reliable system for doing our Mac releases at the same time as our PC ones. So I wouldn't be too shocked to see that there were some issues with the Mac version being not quite as efficient as the PC one. I'm sorry to hear it, but I'm not entirely surprised. We're working to try and get our Mac support to be a lot better than it is currently.
So how much are you seeing? I mean, the iPhone obviously has had a lot of good and bad press about the App Store and how well you can actually make money on that. What's your experience been, and how do you think it's going to go with the other platforms like the Android and Pre?
Well, we've been doing pretty well on the iPhone. Bejeweled has, I think, been pretty consistently in the top 10 or 20 since launch. I think Peggle's done well, and Bookworm's done pretty good. So we've done okay with it. It's definitely an interesting and challenging platform, in that the sheer number of apps out there means that unless you have some way of standing out from that crowd, there's a very high risk with it. So, yeah, I mean, if you're EA and you have that ability to get big brands out there, or, you know, if you're like PopCap, where you have a couple, you know, name games like Bejeweled that people recognize and will seek out, you have an advantage there. But if you're a brand new developer working on an iPhone game, it's a little scary. Everyone hears about the stories of the guy who, you know, wrote a game in his spare time for 2 months and then put it up on the iPhone store and made, you know, $250,000 and quits his day job and all that. But there's a lot of stories that don't end like that, in the same way that, you know, when you hear about guys going to Vegas and betting their last 20 bucks on, you know, on a slot machine and getting rich, that does happen. But is not necessarily a typical story. And it's easy to overlook the risks when you only hear the, you know, the sort of success stories. So I think the iPhone is a really cool platform. I think it's a risky one for, even for small developers. And I think for large developers, they've already kind of started to realize that it's hard to justify a large development budget for an iPhone game. So, you know, they might do it as a marketing tie-in with another game, or, you know, occasionally if they have a very, very casual, friendly, you know, title like, you know, EA with Scrabble. But for example, right now, you, no one's going, not too many people are going to think about investing $1 million in making an iPhone game because the risks are just way too high that you'll never make any of that money back. That may change in the future with Android and you know, other platforms that sort of are similar to iPhone. If they start having more touchscreen app store type devices, that might suddenly multiply the potential audience for some of these games by a large amount. I mean, the iPhone is cool, but it's compared to other mobile phones, it's really still owned by a small percentage of people. That might change. In a year or two, you might see, you know, iPhone-like devices in a lot of people's hands. And, you know, if the UI and the App Store experience are similar to the, you know, the iPhone, that may have a huge impact on the way games work. Suddenly you may find that audience, you know, not just growing by a small amount, but doubling, tripling, you know, quadrupling, you know, overnight if some new phones in that category become popular.
So I have a question from Tim O'Reilly. He wants to know, and so you have to answer this because it's Tim. How do you go about getting new customers? And he says, be specific.
How do I go about getting new customers? Okay, well, I'll try to be. Well, I'll maybe mention two things. You know, one is the not very exciting, you know, answer, which is we do what a lot of people do in the casual game space: is you do search engine marketing. It's a very, that's the most common way on the web to drive people to download games from a casual game site is search engine marketing, largely through Google, where you buy keywords for various things and people search and blah, blah, blah. You know, you pay a certain amount and they click through, and it's fairly mechanical now because people, we have metrics to know out of, if this many people download the game, you'll sell this many on average and so forth. So that's kind of the non-interesting way that we get new customers. The more interesting ways, well, one example would be Facebook, for example. We've been looking at social networking games for a while, and there've been some kind of interesting things going around there, but we weren't too sure, you know, if it was a good idea for us to get into it. It wasn't really our forte, but at the same time, it was a very different kind of crowd, a very different, you know, space for us to try something with. So that was the idea behind Bejeweled Blitz, is to get into a completely different, you know, market than the ones we were in at the time. And sure enough, that, you know, it has done quite well on Facebook in terms of getting Bejeweled out in front of people who otherwise had not maybe seen, you know, Bejeweled very much. And it is a very different crowd on Facebook. The players there are not the types who, they don't, most of them don't play very many games at all. So even by the standards of casual games, they're not the type who even download a game. They don't do any games whatsoever. So yeah, so that's been a way of expanding our user base to a whole different crowd through that.
One of the ways that you market your games is through what one of our artists calls teaser apps. You wanted to know, what's your conversion rate like on those? Is it an effective way of marketing the games?
If it means the web sort of flash games and so on the web, that is pretty effective. It's less effective than it was when we started, you know, about 8 or 9 years ago, where that was by and large the primary way that you drove people to get interested in games. There'd be a flash game on some website, or at that time a Java game. And, you know, the player would, you know, play a bit of Bejeweled or whatever it was, and then there'd be some sort of ad saying, if you want the deluxe experience, you know, download, you know, Bejeweled Deluxe. And then they'd download that, and, you know, and then they would hopefully buy that. It's less important nowadays. More people are willing to download a game directly, and fewer people feel the need to play the web game first before doing that. And also, there are a lot of flash games out there that don't have any sort of downloadable component. So people who are playing a lot of flash games are not always in the market for downloadable stuff either. That said, it is still useful, and the conversion rates, boy, they vary a lot for different types of things. I mean, I think once someone downloads a game, the typical conversion rates are usually in the range of 1 to 5%. So if you can get somebody to download a copy of Peggle, for example, the typical conversion rates are in the 1 to 5% range of those people will actually end up buying it.
You brought up, you've mentioned Flash a couple of times. There are some players out there who are pure Flash players like Armor. Are they, do you see them as a serious competitor to what you're doing? Or because, to some extent you get the same thing with newspapers are going through. If people are giving it away, how do you make money at it?
I don't think, as far as we've seen anyway, the pure Flash game guys don't really seem to be competing for the same audience that we are. Sites like Miniclip and so on, they do okay with their own business model. It doesn't seem to be crossing over with ours. The problem with developing Flash games for those kinds of sites is that it can be very difficult to turn a profit on them because there's so many Flash games out there. So a site like Miniclip, or some of the other ones like that, they pay a pretty small amount of money for a Flash game, between maybe $500 to $5,000, basically, and that's it in most cases. And so if you're a Flash developer, that's a pretty small amount of money, and unless you're making the game in 1 or 2 days. There are a few outfits like Armor Games, you point out, that do actually, produce games, of a higher level of polish and so forth. As for how they make money, I don't know. That's a good question for them, actually. I'm kind of curious. I suspect it's a fairly tough business right now, just because of the massive commodification of Flash games. And so I definitely have heard from a lot of Flash game developers who, despite churning out lots and lots of games all the time, some of them are doing a game a day or whatever, they still have a hard time making ends meet just because the prices and so on are just not good for the pure Flash plays.
I've got just a couple more questions and I'll let you get going here. How international is your development effort and how do you manage it technically and logistically?
How international? Well, we have a development office in Dublin in Ireland, and about 40 people, and they handle the bulk of our internationalization. So yeah, so we take it fairly seriously. It's work. It's kind of it takes time and money to do a decent job with it. But yeah, we try to the majority of our games we try to end up eventually internationalizing. Usually, there's some kind of decisions. There's EFIGS, which is English, French, Italian, German, Spanish, and that's sort of the basic level for doing European coverage. Beyond that, the typical next steps would be to maybe do some of the Asian languages, Japanese, Korean, and Chinese. And we do that as well. We have an office in Shanghai, and they do some of that. Those markets are a little more challenging right now. They're definitely, for various reasons, some of them are that, Japan is very much a console market and has not, got into PC, downloadable stuff very much. China, on the other hand, is well, for, has big problems with piracy. There's just a lot of piracy out there, and Korea obviously has a lot of MMO kind of focus. So casual games are challenging to get done over there. But yeah, but we're trying our best to have a global reach for all of our games.
I was actually, that's a good answer, but I was actually asking, do you have international developers, or is it pretty much all done out of one area?
The majority of our developers are all in the US. I mean, we do have developers in Ireland and Shanghai, but in terms of the games that you'd be familiar with now, the majority of them have been developed in North America, either in Seattle or in some cases in Chicago or Vancouver or San Francisco.
What these days would be the career path for someone who wants to get into game development?
Well, there's a variety of different paths. There are a number of schools that have some kind of game development programs now. I don't know too much about them, and although I think some of them are very interesting, I don't think they're certainly not a requirement. Certainly at PopCap, we don't specifically look for anybody with a game design school background to hire. So, in many cases nowadays, the best way to get into the game industry is just to do it yourself. The barriers to entry are not what they might have been, you know, even 5 or 10 years ago. If you want to make a game now, as I said, you can make a Flash game easily enough yourself. You may not make a lot of money with it, but you can certainly produce it and get it out there in front of people easily enough. And in many ways, the experience of just actually making games is more valuable than any amount of training or books that you can read. So if someone wants to get in the game industry right now, my personal advice would be to just do it. And, you know, whether that means a Flash game or, yeah, there's lots of student collectives or just independent guys making, you know, a variety of things. It's entirely possible to just make a game. You don't have to go to school for it. You can do the traditional path like 10 years ago would have been get a job as a QA guy at, you know, Electronic Arts or Activision or something like that, and then work your way up. And that certainly can work. Or you know, go to school for programming or art and then get a, you know, an entry-level job at a big developer. And those methods are still entirely valid. But if you wanted to get into game design and the sort of the creative side of things, I think you can actually just go ahead and do it now, which was something that 10 years ago was a lot harder to do because there just weren't as many venues for getting your work out there.
So, two fanboy questions to end things. First of all, are we going to see Plants vs. Zombies 2?
I don't know. We'll see. I'd like to see it myself. We have the same challenge with that as we do with some of our other games in that the guy who made Plants vs. Zombies, George Fan, is hard at work on another game. And so it's a tough one in that we like his new game. We'd like him to work on that. We'd certainly like Plants vs. Zombies 2, you know, as well as that. But it's challenging in that no one besides George would really do as good of a job on Plants vs. Zombies. So we don't necessarily want to just hand it off to a B team and, you know, and produce something that's not as good. So it's a challenge. I'd like to see it happen, but, you know, we'll see what we can do.
And finally, do the words in Zuma actually mean anything?
The words that the various chants and so forth that you hear? Yes, actually. They do mean something. The chants in the original Zuma are, well, they're mangled Aztec. So as much as people know of what Aztecs actually talk like, the words in there are very bad, you know, badly grammaticized versions of that. I think some of the things say stuff like "too bad, little frog," when you die and stuff and so on. And in the second one, Zuma's Revenge, there is actually, again, a very badly mangled version of the Easter Island in dialect, which is in existence still and known by you know, Easter Islanders to some extent. So yes, it's possible some people out there in Easter Island, if they played Zuma's Revenge, might recognize a few of the phrases.
All right. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Well, thank you. Hopefully that was useful.